It's an honor to be here to introduce someone who I only became acquainted with really about a year ago when his email hit my email, and it was an article that he wrote called "The Chickens Come Home to Roost." Ooh, like she's in church, I heard that. And it was so stunning. I had never in my life before heard anyone outside of my own race of people identify some of the issues that Mr. Weiss identified. So I got really, really excited and became someone who wanted to read more about him, know more about him, and get to a point where I thought I could trust what he was actually saying, and I think I've definitely achieved that. What inspired me about him is that his research went beyond conjecture. It was factual, and he was able to back up the facts. So it wasn't just light conversation. This was reality that he was talking about. He displays a sense of personal responsibility and accountability, because not only does he talk about the issues that we're facing, but he talks to us about how we can heal from those issues. And when asked earlier today, when he did a forum with a group of young people, well, wouldn't it be easier to just write and not really write as a white person? I mean, don't you think that would be effective as well? And in addition to his answer of, you know, his point is to write as a white person, in addition to making that point very, very clear, he talked more about taking accountability. If, in fact, we are going to be activists and we're going to heal from racism, we need to be responsible and accountable. Talks about the invisibility of whiteness, and he is someone who started out at Tulane University and was very involved in the anti-apartheid movement there. And he learned some lessons about the culture of activism, and I hope that he'll share some of those with you today. I'm going to read just a little bit from his bio, since it's not printed in your program, but allow me to tell you that he is a prominent white anti-racist. He is one of the most prominent voices in America. A social justice activist for 2 decades, he's spoken in 46 states and told me today that he had 50 speeches over the last month or so.
No, 5 months.
5 months, okay. All right, I feel better.
Still bad.
I feel better. Okay, all right, good. And he's toured to every major college university that you can think of and spoken to students there. He's also trained journalists in how to eliminate racial bias in reporting as a visiting faculty member at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. I wish he could come to Seattle and do some of that. He's an advisor to the Fisk University Race Relations Institute in Nashville, Tennessee, and in the early 90s was associate director of the Louisiana Coalition Against Racism and Nazism. And he has been the recipient of a number of awards for his contributions to the racial struggle. His anti-racism efforts have been hailed as revolutionary by NYU professor and leading social critic Robin D.G. Kelly. And a thorn, quote, a thorn in the side of white supremacists, unquote, by Dr. Raymond Winbush of Morgan State University. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Tim Weiss.
Thank you for that introduction. I feel a bit self-conscious about thanking you for it, since I wrote most of that. I didn't make up the quote from either Dr. Winbush or Dr. Kelly, nor did I make up any of it. It's all true, I guess, but it is somewhat self-serving for me to thank you for the introduction when I wrote most of it. So let me instead give you a different kind of introduction. I know many of you, either as friends who I've had for some time, or perhaps colleagues in some sense within the anti-racist struggle. Others of you I've only met very briefly. Others of you I may have exchanged emails with at some point, as I often do with the thousands of people who write me either to yell at me or thank me or ask me if I'm really white or whatever it is that they ask me. You may be one of the people that I had to send photographic evidence of my whiteness to. when that very article about the Santee shooting that we were talking about a second ago came out. But I want to give you a different introduction, whether you know me or whether you don't. I did it today in the workshop that we did here at 2:30, and it seemed to be fairly effective for the folks in the audience for that. And so I'm going to do it again, because I think it speaks to this issue we're talking about today of white privilege. As you know, I'm a writer, I'm a lecturer, I'm an activist specializing in issues of race relations, and more than that, institutional racism and addressing this issue of white privilege. And I am here today to give this talk and was here earlier to do that workshop, and I have the reputation that I have doing that work in large part because of the work that I did in the early 1990s in New Orleans, Louisiana, fighting David Duke, which was a very high-profile kind of thing, and so naturally allowed me to gain a certain reputation for the work that I did. And I got to do the work against David Duke in 1990, 91, and 92, really for only one reason. I happened to be in New Orleans at the right time when David Duke was running for the United States Senate and then for governor and then for president and then for Congress and then for whatever it was he felt like running for. And I was there because I was going to college at Tulane University from 1986 to 90. I was only at Tulane University from 1986 to 1990 because my mother was able to take out a loan shortly before the beginning of my freshman year at the bank because I, in my way of procrastinating, had forgotten to send in the financial aid reports. But my mom, to her credit, went to the bank and was able to get a loan to pay for my first year of college, which allowed me to go to Tulane, which allowed me to be in New Orleans, which allowed me to do the anti-David Duke work, which allowed me to get known for this work, which allowed me to get a writing gig, and allowed me to get all these speaking gigs, and allowed me to be here today. My mother was able to get the loan at the bank for only one reason. Her mother was able to put up her house as collateral. My mother has never owned a home. My mother was at that time renting the same apartment that we had lived in since I was 3 days old, but her mother, to my undying gratitude, was able to put up her house as collateral for the loan that it was going to take to send me to Tulane University. And my grandmother was only able to take out the loan that allowed me to go to Tulane, which allowed me to be in New Orleans, which allowed me to fight David Duke, which allowed me to get a rep for doing this work, which allowed me to get the speaking gigs and the writing gigs and be here tonight, because her husband, that's my grandfather, follow closely, was able to acquire the wealth of that house and two houses prior to that at a time when in those neighborhoods and in those places and those kinds of houses were not capable of being rented and or owned and possessed by people of color in that town, in that neighborhood at that time. And he was able to acquire that wealth because of his lifelong career both in the military and the civil service, the military which he entered during World War II in officer candidacy school at a time when it was essentially off limits to anyone who was not of color, then went into the civil service after serving in World War II at a time when the civil service, though not off limits to people of color, might as well have been. It was certainly segregated and white supremacist in orientation. And because of his work, he was able to acquire a little wealth, buy a house, buy another house at a time when people of color couldn't do so. And when he died, his wife, my grandmother, got the house, which she was able to put up as collateral for my mother's loan to be able to send me to Tulane so that I could be in New Orleans, so that I could fight David Duke, so that I could get a rep for doing this work, so that I could get a writing gig and a speaking gig and be here with you tonight. And now, not to leave out the other side of the family, because there's more to the story, my father's side also helped out by giving me cash to buy books and do all the kinds of stuff that one does in New Orleans and does not always have the money for oneself. And so my father's father, that would be my grandfather, my Jewish grandfather, also was able to pass on certain assets and wealth and income to me because he too, despite anti-Semitism, had been able to become white, and that is to say then take advantage of his white skin and his European ancestry, and passed down some of that to me, having acquired assets, running a business, I might add, in the black community, that he was then able to make money from and buy a house in a place where people of color couldn't buy it. And then he was able to pass some of that down to his son, my father, who could pass some of that down to me, which in combination with my grandmother's home as collateral was allowing me to get the loan from my mother to go to Tulane to put me in New Orleans to do, well, you know the rest of the story. And this was a Jewish grandfather, by the way, who had been able to go to Vanderbilt University in the late 1930s and early 1940s, when black folks most certainly could not, and when other people of color most certainly could not, and when many people of color, particularly Asian Pacific Islanders, were essentially being barred from even entering the country were they not already here. And his father, my Jewish great-grandfather, who only stepped off the boat from Russia in 1910, Many years after the end of slavery, many years after the beginning of Jim Crow segregation, and despite his interaction with anti-Semitism and Jew hatred in this land, which he certainly encountered because of his accent, because of his religion, because of his culture, his national heritage, nonetheless was able to get jobs strictly off limits to people of color on day one off the boat in New York, then able to save a little money which he could pass down to his son, my grandfather, which he would then use to open a business in the black community, allowing him to give me some of that income down through my father, which in combination with my grandmother's collateral of her house on my mother's side, again, you know the rest of the story. And we could go back even further to my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, who came to this country in 1735, prior to the even founding of this country as a country, when we were but colonies prior to the Revolution, given 10,000 acres of land. Now 10,000 acres of land in North Carolina, because he surveyed the property for the state, or for the territory. Surveyed some property. Now, what does that mean? It means you go out and you walk about 500 yards and you say, there is a tree over yonder and a hill down that way. And here, I told you about it, so give me some land. And they did, 10,000 acres, and they threw in another 1,000 during the Revolutionary War, because when soldiers would get injured, he would let them rest at his house. So on land where black folks had been working and toiling for centuries without the right to as much as own their name, he was able to own 11,000 acres of land, which he passed down to his son, my great-great-great-great-grandfather, who passed it down to his, who passed it down to his, who passed it down to his, and eventually worked its way to the current generation. And of course, he only came into this country in 1735, because we've always had a pretty open border policy with regard to the Scottish. Which is all to say that I'm here today because I'm good at what I do, or at least that is what folks tell me, but I'm just as much and just as importantly here today because of the topic we address today. I am here today not because of my good works, nor my talent, nor my charm, nor my skill at turning a phrase. I am here in large part because of this thing called white privilege. If you take out any one of the elements I have just rattled off to you, the entire house of cards would look very different. And any one of those things being removed could potentially render all of my hard work and all of my effort for naught, because it took all of those things working in concert to create the person that I am today. I am not my own person. I am not merely an individual, despite my nation and my culture's tendency to want to make me into that. I am a product of a system of privilege in combination with hard work. But hard work is something that pretty much characterizes the entire human species. What doesn't characterize the entire human species is access to an opportunity structure, which I have had for now going on 270 some odd years. And I want to dedicate what I say tonight, particularly because this is a prima facie event. I want to dedicate the remarks and do justice and do honor to five people in particular whose last names I do not know. Actually, I do. They are the same last name as my mother's family's family name, even though they were only members of the family the way an armoire or a footstool or a bed or a house or a pig or a pot or a pan were members of the family. They were members as property. Their first names are Sim, Minerva, Jenny, Jerry, and Sylvie. I do not know anything more about them, but to say that they were passed down from one generation to another generation to another generation. Them and, quote, all their further increase, end of quote. That was the way such folks' children, prior to their being born, were described, all their further increase. And so I hope that tonight my remarks about white privilege and my accountability for addressing this issue will extend not only to today's living descendants of those enslaved after the Maafa Middle Passage and this great terror that took place on this land, but indeed to that generation enslaved and owned by my family. But see, to discuss this issue of white privilege is a difficult thing for many of us who are called white to do, because it requires us to do something we definitely are not ready to do, and that is to forever abandon this silly, infantile, liberal, colorblind model of race relations in favor of something else, you see. Now, I'm going someplace that folk will not want me to go. And I did that back at MLK. Some of y'all saw it. Some of y'all were in the audience. And you know I said some things that made some people uneasy. But I said I was going to do it, so I didn't let, you know. I telegraphed the punch. It was coming, you know. And I'm telegraphing this one. The problem is not, or at least not exclusively, the far right. It's not ultra-conservatives, it's not neo-fascists, it's not neo-Nazis, it's not Klansmen, it's not skinheads. It is this colorblind model of race relations that says that we ought not notice people as black, as white, and all that. We ought to just all love one another, get along, hold hands, sing kumbaya. But you see, if we cannot notice color, if I'm not allowed to notice color, then I'm not going to have a very easy time understanding or acknowledging the consequences of color, as Julian Bond says. And if color has consequences, but you're telling me I can't notice them because to notice them is impolite. And to notice them is to make an issue out of something and to divide us, and we ought to just be coming together. So let's be colorblind, but then see, if we're colorblind, we can't discuss white privilege because white is in the phrase. See? We can't talk about white privilege because then to do that, you have to say white. And then white people go, well, now you're not being colorblind because you're noticing white. White's the one color we're not allowed to notice. It's the only one we don't notice. Oh, white people don't notice it. People of color notice it. Okay. It's very opaque to people of color. But to the rest of us, those of us defined as white, we have that luxury of invisibility, and we don't like folk pointing out that there's a system of whiteness, a system of white supremacy or domination, a system of white privilege, because we take it all personally. You know, it's funny, we take it personally even though we turn around and say we're not responsible for it. We didn't set it up, we didn't create it, we didn't do it. I didn't own Sim, Minerva, Jenny, Jerry, Sylvie, and all their further increased Tim. Your people did. I didn't do it, you see. Well, if you didn't do it and you didn't get anything from it, then why are you getting so upset when I talk about it? Just let it roll off your back. Right? You don't get defensive about things that don't apply to you, but the colorblind model says we can't notice it. We can't notice who's up and who's down and ask why, you see. Because to do that requires that we notice this thing called color and the consequences of it. We can't address the inequality of white privilege if we can't address white privilege, if we can't name it, if we can't call it out. To mention it is to violate that we're all the same and we're all in this together model, but we're not. We're not. So people said, I heard after the MLK thing, folks were saying, now, MLK Day, is it, we're just supposed to talk about what brings us together, and this guy gets up there, and he talks about all this stuff that brings us apart. Now, if that's going to be our model, we can't talk about the things that divide us. Well, what does that mean? It means we can't talk about racism. Because racism doesn't bring people together. By definition, it drives people apart. So we can't talk about that, because that's a downer. You know, we got to talk about ethnic food. And we got to talk about ethnic dance and ethnic clothing. And we got to talk about cultural appreciation and tolerance and loving diversity and all that good stuff, because that brings us together. Because you see, we're just all Americans, but we're not, because we haven't all been treated just like Americans. And the reason for it is this thing called white privilege. And if we don't talk about that, if we don't name whiteness, if we don't discuss it, then it becomes difficult, if not impossible, to understand where people of color are coming from when they are discussing racism. You see, because if it's opaque to them and invisible to us, because it can be, because we have that luxury of not seeing it, then when we talk with people of color, and we're white folks talking with people of color about racism, we're talking about two totally different things. Maybe three, four, five, six, seven different things. Not talking about the same thing because we're not using the same language. So we have to name whiteness, we have to discuss it, because otherwise we're not going to really understand what people of color are talking about when they talk about the flip side of that privilege, which is what? Oppression. It's a word we don't like to use, right? We're much happier using these passive words. We love passive language. We say things like less fortunate. Right? Less fortunate. Here's fortune. Here you are, just a little bit less. We could just find you a little fortune, bring you up to here, it'd all be cool in the carpool. Right? Or underprivileged. Underprivileged. Here's privilege, here you are under it. Just find you a little privilege, bring you up to here, everything will be fine. Now, where's your privilege that we're going to try and find? Now, you can't ask that. You want me to help find the privilege that the underprivileged don't have? Where is it? What's the opposite of underprivileged? Yeah, overprivileged. Now, have you ever heard that term used in polite company before? You'll hear the term privilege, you'll never hear anyone say overprivileged. We act like the opposite of underprivileged is just privilege, but that's not true. If someone is under what they ought to be, then that's because someone else has more of what they're not supposed to have. That is the opposite, the flip side of under. So if we talk about underprivileged people, which we have no problem doing, because it's passive, it doesn't imply that anybody did anything to anybody. Folk just woke up and here was privilege and here they were. How'd that happen? It's like the bumper sticker says. You know the R-rated version. I'll give you the PG version. The PG version is stuff happens. Right? You know the hard version. Stuff happens. Stuff doesn't just happen. Only a very privileged person could believe that. This is a bumper sticker that I know had to be created by my people, because there's no way that people of color would have come up with a sticker that says stuff happens, because they know better. Stuff gets done. Okay? Stuff gets done by people to people. Right? And back again, and back and around again. It doesn't just happen, right? But we use this passive language, and that's the problem. We can't have an honest dialogue if we keep using this passive language. Now, the other problem with talking about white privilege is that we always have the folks who want to say what? They want to say, well, now, not all white people are privileged, because they're poor white people. I have been one of those poor white people. Okay? I have been one of those white folks just above the poverty line, literally, but of course had some family to turn to. So the fact that my mom and dad didn't make a lot of money and we were just this much above welfare receipt, poverty stricken, if we used an honest definition of poverty in this country, which we don't, we would have been under the poverty line. But we had that family we could turn to. So even in the worst of our times, we had a little access to something that for the most part, the overwhelming number of people of color don't have. And what I find so interesting about this discussion, that somehow, well, since there are poor white people, there's no such thing as white privilege. What seems so preposterous about that is it ignores how racial privilege operates within a class system. Okay? We take it for granted. We understand, if we're paying attention, that we have a class system, that we have stratification and inequality on the basis of economics. And within that class system, the fact that there are white folks who are poorer than Oprah Winfrey doesn't mean anything. Because if I'm poor and I'm white and I go to the bank to get a loan and Oprah walks in next to me, I'm not competing for the same house as Oprah. We understand that. She can buy and sell me 20 times over. That doesn't change the reality of white privilege, because I'm coming in with my $50,000 in income or my $30,000 or my $20,000. And I'm competing with the black, the Latino, the Asian Pacific American, the indigenous person with 50, with 30, with 20, not Oprah. You see, within a class system, we compete against people from our own basic economic background. And that's where the racial privilege comes in at every level. And Oprah's competing with Bill Gates. And who you think wins that competition? And if Oprah goes into downtown Chicago without her makeup on to try to buy jewelry, her millions aren't going to protect her. I'll actually get the jewelry before she will. And if Tiger Woods walks on the wrong side of New York City without the Nike cap on and without flashing the smile that we all recognize, he's Amadou Diallo. Right? And so all of these folks who people trot out now to say, well, there's not racial privilege because there are these people of color, all of whom I can name, it seems. It's funny, you know. When you can name all the people that disprove the rule still stands, folks. And if you're honest and you take it out of the racial context, this is so obvious. What I'm saying really isn't controversial if we take it out of the race context for a second and think about it in other ways. Like, for example, I think we would all probably acknowledge that to be in this country, the richest, whatever that means, most powerful, most dominant nation, probably in the history of the world, in some capacity, has given us as Americans or as people in this land, be they citizens or be they just folks who are living here, certain advantages, certain opportunities above the vast majority of the world's population. We're clear on that. Now, how we got all that wealth, you know, is up for dispute. okay. But we got it. And so as a nation, we have certain privileges, certain advantages, certain one-up, if you will, on the vast majority of the people on the globe. But now, does that dispute? Of course, there are people in other parts of the globe, in other parts of the world, who are better off than some Americans. We understand that. There are people in the United States who are worse off economically in terms of their, you know, prestige and status than some people in other parts of the world. Does that mean that there isn't such a thing as American national privilege and advantage? No, it just means that as with anything, there can always be individuals who may, in some sense, go against the grain of the rule, but it doesn't disprove the rule. Similarly, there are people with a lot of money economically privileged, and we all understand there is this thing of class privilege. There are rich folk who have miserable lives, who aren't healthy, they got all kinds of stress, they're not happy, they don't get along with their spouse, their lover, their partner, their children, their friends, they don't have any friends, they're miserable human beings. And there are some folks who are poor, who actually have lower blood pressure, are healthier, are happier. But does that mean there's not such a thing as class privilege? Well, of course not. We wouldn't even think to make that kind of an absurd comment, that there's no such thing as class privilege just because some poor people are better off, you know, physically and emotionally than some rich people. Similarly, with ability status and physical ability, we all, I think, would admit that folks who are physically able-bodied have certain advantages, certain privileges. We have certain access, certain immunities, if you will, certain opportunities that are either off limits or much harder to come by for those who have physical disabilities. It's a privileged status to be able-bodied. Does that mean that there aren't some people with disabilities who are richer than folks who are able-bodied? Well, of course not. Right? There are folks who we may very well know who are very well off, have lots of prestige, lots of status, despite a serious physical disability that has limited them in some way or resulted in discrimination against them. Does that deny the reality of able-bodied privilege? Of course not, you see. And that's not controversial when I put it in those contexts. But then you bring it back to race, and we're supposed to believe that because there are some white folks worse off than some people of color, therefore this reality of white privilege as a system doesn't exist. Well, that just doesn't make any sense. It's not rational. It's not logical. It doesn't follow the facts. It doesn't follow basic common sense. But people say it anyway. Now, I could sit here and rattle off to you all of the statistical information about the material privileges that whites enjoy throughout all levels of the class system, in jobs, in education, in lending and banking, in the criminal justice system. But I'm not going to do it because I want to spend some time on other things. And if you're interested in it, you can find that data. It's out there. Like the saying, the truth is out there. The truth is out there. The data is clear, whether you're talking about lending, education, job opportunities, the criminal justice system, housing, any of these different institutional sectors. The advantages that obtain to those of us defined as white are massive and amount to billions of dollars worth of additional assets in terms of housing, tens of billions of dollars in additional assets in terms of income and money received in wages every year, even when we're not any more qualified and often less qualified than our counterparts of color. We know what the privileges are in the criminal justice system if we pay attention to things like racial profiling and who gets shot for holding the remote control in their hand and who doesn't. Made some people angry with that one in January, so I thought I'd throw it out there again. But I don't have to go through any of those numbers. All I have to do is ask you the following question, and you ask it to other folk out there, and it'll make the point as well as any statistic will. Let us pretend for a minute that I had a pill with me tonight that I could offer to you. And this pill was magic. And I offered it to everybody in the room who was white. And what this pill would do is it would render you, in the eyes of anyone who didn't already know you, strangers like police officers you don't know, possible employers you don't know, loan officers at banks you don't know, security guards at the mall you don't know, people who see you on the street or in elevators that you don't know, would render you black or brown. Now, to the people who already knew and loved you, you'd still be your old self. So I'm not doing the experiment Andrew Hacker did a few years back where he said, you know, how much would it take for you if you're white to become black? Because that experiment was frankly flawed, because most people don't want to change who they are, right, in either direction. Most people don't want to become something they're not. I'm modifying the experiment. That's not my experiment. I'm telling you, you get to stay who you are in the eyes of everybody who knows you and when you look in the mirror. But people who don't already know you, strangers to you, who you have to go ask for a job, a loan, who you have to interact with when you're shopping or when they stop you on the street, they will see you as black or brown. Now, do you take the pill or do you say, I think you better keep the pill, Tim. Well, now we know what the answer is. There is not one of us, if we're being honest, that says, yeah, man, give me that pill. Give me all the pills you got. I want to be seen as black or brown in the eyes of law enforcement, in the eyes of bankers, in the eyes of employers, in the eyes of my teachers. Nothing could be better than that. Give it to me, you know. But yet now we say, even as we admit we wouldn't take the pill, we still got folks running around saying what? That the only real victim of discrimination today is the white male. Now, if that's true, hell, you'd want to take every pill I have, right? You would be paying the FDA to approve this pill. You would be on the internet buying it, forgetting Viagra, forgetting all these other things. You'd be buying the black and brown pill. If you really believed that the butter was on the black and brown side of the bread, and that everything had flip-flopped. It's the very fact that nobody's taking the pill and nobody's pushing for it. And you don't even have to take the pill. You can go take Sorlin, which is already available. That's what John Howard Griffith took when he wrote Black Like Me. And that'll turn you black. And you can go on out there with your black self and get all those advantages and all those goodies that they say you get when you're black nowadays. And you can leave all that whiteness behind. And I don't see folk lining up to take that pill either, because we know, even without any statistics, without any research, without any data, all of which I could provide if I wanted to waste your time and mine, we know what the truth is. It operates invisibly to those of us who are white, even though it's opaque to people of color. And it's not just the material advantages. It's the fact that our entire mentality, those of us in the dominant group, becomes the norm. The normative mentality, the default position of the society in which we live, right? It is considered normal and regular, and so we don't have to give it a whole lot of thought. And so when something like 9/11 happens, folks can say what? Without any sense of irony at all or misgiving, they can say two things which are stunning for how dripping they are with the condescension of white privilege. One, united we stand. Now, who is we? And how long have we been we? And when were the tryouts for this team? United, who stands? See, because you talk about being a united nation when people of color have 2 to 3 times the poverty rate of white folks, 2 to 3 times the unemployment rate, regardless of the health of the economy, right? 65% of all the people in jails and prisons today, black or brown, only 1/3 are white, even though 35 years ago it was the exact opposite. If we have a nation like that, and we talk about being united, then something says to me that we're just either lying to ourselves or we're just not paying attention. You see? But we say it because we can say that. Then the other one we have that was even better. Seemed like an innocuous comment, but it wasn't. And this was how it went. You heard it. After 9/11, folks said, now we know what it means to be attacked for who we are. Now we know. Naeem Akbar said it best a few months after 9/11. He said, George Bush may have discovered terrorism on September 11th. But for some people, terrorism wasn't really all that new. The only thing new about it, the only thing really new and unique about it was that it came from outside the shores of our country, for some people for the first time. You see, it always been there in the neighborhood, always been there in the workplace, always been there in the jails and the prisons, always been there in the schools. Terrorism that kills folks every bit as well and every bit as dead, albeit maybe a little more slowly and not on TV as those who perpetrated the acts of 9/11, but we said, now we know. And that too is a position of privilege. That's what's called universalizing the particular. Taking one's particular perspective, which comes from one's particular experience, and saying that is the experience of the whole country. And so white folks can say, this is what, you know, this is what the American experience is. Well, that's the experience of some folks. It's like back a few years ago during the refugee crisis in Kosovo, I was watching CNN and they were talking about it. And the reporter, the host of the show, Talk Back Live, you know, it's that one where they all sit around in what looks like a shopping mall with big buttons on it, says, hi, my name is Bob. Right? And Bob wants to say something, you know. So they interview Bob, and Bob says something, and then the host makes some comment, and then they go to break, and the host's comment was, well, you know, we as Americans just don't know what it's like to be uprooted from our homes and turned into refugees, and we shouldn't take that for granted. I damn near fell out of bed. Because once again, we're using we in a very interesting way. Now, who doesn't know what it means to be uprooted? See, Sim and Sylvie and Jerry and Jenny and Minerva and all their further increase, their people knew what it was to be uprooted. Mexicans who lost half their country in a war that we started know what it is to be uprooted. Native people don't know much else but being uprooted since we got here. And Japanese Americans certainly know what it is to be uprooted and stuck into internment camps. And Chinese Americans know what it is to be uprooted and used to build railroads or mine to make money for wealthier white folks and told that you can't bring your wife or your family into the country. We just want your labor. And then we'll ship you back. And then Mexican Americans in the middle of the last century, many of them citizens sent back across the border and deported under the Bracero program and sent away from this country, know what it is to be uprooted. Only a few people don't know what it is to be uprooted forcibly from their homes. But see, the folks who don't know are the folks who write copy for CNN. And the folks who do know don't write copy for CNN. And that's the difference. You see, white privilege. The privilege to define reality for everybody and expect your definition of it to stick. Because you got the power to make it stick. Now the last thing I want to talk about before I'm done and before we have our breakout type sessions is this. You know, I've talked a little bit about what some of these privileges are. Some of them are material, some of them are psychological. Some of them are very real and personal to us. And other times when I've gone through the whole litany, which I won't do here tonight because I saw in the handout, you know, we're taking it for granted that there is this thing called white privilege. We're not here to debate that, right? And so I'm not going to have to prove it and go through all the permutations of proof that I might, you know. But sometimes when I do that, it's very interesting because what very perceptive people in the audience will do is they'll say, well, Tim, hey, man, you did a great job. You ran down all those privileges. You and Peggy McIntosh list all these privileges. Good stuff, man. You did it. You convinced some of your folks tonight that there's this thing called white privilege. Now answer me one question. Now that you've done your job and you've proven how many privileges there are, tell me why in the world all these folks that you've just convinced would want to give that up. Because we're not a culture that tells you to get rid of your privileges. Am I right? Right. Our parents teach us to count our blessings, not give them away. Right. Be grateful for what you have. Not so you can give it away, just so you'll be grateful. Right? We're supposed to take advantage of our advantage. That's what our culture tells us to do. Our very competitive culture tells us you capitalize on your advantages. You take advantage of them. So if you prove that there's this thing called white privilege, the natural reaction, even of good-hearted, decent people, in the white community is to say, well, damn, you know, I didn't realize all that, but now that I do, I'm not going to give that. I'm not a fool. What am I, some kind of idiot? I mean, I feel bad and all, but I'm not, whoa, you know. So the question is, why would you give it up? And I think this is a very important and unanswered question in this movement. We've got to explain this in a way that allows those of us called white to understand what in fact is in it for the entire community to eliminate white privilege. Because see, it's my position that white privilege is not just effective at killing people of color. It is killing white people. Now, we don't realize it, but for the vast majority of people defined in this culture as white, this privilege is destroying us. It's destroying us internally. It's destroying us externally. It costs us billions of dollars every year on a purely financial level, discrimination against people of color who are, in fact, not just people of color, black folks alone. This is who the study's been done on. If it had been done on Latinos and Asian Pacific Americans and Native peoples, the number would be much higher. Discrimination just against black folks and just in the labor market costs the country $240 billion a year in lost income every single year. That's the entire economy, not just black folks that lose that. Our economy loses that. It's about 4.5% of our overall economy every year, just sort of gone because people aren't being paid what they're worth. And so then they can't pay taxes at the same level as others. They can't produce as productively. They're not as efficient as workers because their productive capacity is not being tapped. You know all the economic theories, right? And so on the one level, it's just a huge waste of money, which harms us all. But even more than that, white privilege allows those of us defined as white to remain isolated. 80 to 85% of white folks live in communities where there are almost no people of color around in that direct neighborhood or adjoining neighborhoods, which means we are isolated and we know far less about people of color than they know about us, which isn't very functional for a nation that is increasingly not like us. and a world that never was, right? For a long time, we were able to live under this illusion that the world was white and that America was white. America has never been white, and the world most certainly has never been white, right? Most of the people in the world are not white, they don't speak English, they're not Christian, they're poor, and they're female. So they don't look anything like the folks who run the show in this place, right? And so if we talk only about them having to assimilate to our norm and get to understand our ways, and we're isolated from a more global norm, which is much more of color and much more culturally different than what we may be used to, then we're the ones who are unqualified for damn near everything in the 21st century. You see? So that's how it harms. It also harms us by increasing the likelihood of our falling prey to those racist stereotypes that are so common. See, when you're isolated from people of color, it's much easier to think that stuff about them, that they're dangerous and they're horrible and they're coming to get you and they're going to rob you and rape you and beat you and maim you. Because that's the imagery you get in the media. That's what you see on Cops. That's what you see on Real Stories of the Highway Patrol. And you don't have the personal interaction to disprove it, so you fall prey to the stereotype. And then what happens? You let your guard down to the folk building 50 bombs in your basement because you hadn't talked to them in a week and a half, and they look just like you because you gave birth to them. They're your own children. They're the children of somebody else. And so white folks are five times more likely to be attacked by another white person than by a black person, but we're looking out for black people and looking out for Latinos and looking out for poor folk generally. Meanwhile, that's not the folks who pose the greatest risk to those of us in those white enclaves. So we let down our guard to the real danger because we're looking for the danger down the block. And then when chaos comes to our community, we get on television and we say, this wasn't supposed to happen here. You know, Victor Lewis, who's one of the cast members of Color of Fear, and I know some of you know Victor, has this great analogy. He says, one of the greatest costs of privilege to those who have it that they don't realize, it's sort of like the Titanic. You ever see the movie The Titanic? I know some of you did. You don't want to admit it because it's sort of sappy, but it made an awful lot of money, so some of you went two or three times. And did you ever notice now when the Titanic hits the iceberg and rips the hole in the bottom of the ship? Now, who are the first folks getting wet? The folks in steerage, right? The poor folks who couldn't afford a better seat, a better bed, a better cabin, right? And so they're the ones down there playing cards, having a much better time, actually, than these stuffy folks on the promenade deck. But that's a different story. And they're the ones getting wet. Now, they know what chaos is because it's all around their feet and they can see the water coming up. Right, it's gaining, it's gaining 6 inches every 30 minutes. Ooh, this is bad news. But of course, now they probably are yelling up to the folks on top, hey, now we have a problem down here. But see, the folks on top have the luxury of not paying any attention to the people on the bottom because they never did, they never had to. Right? They have the luxury of ignoring them, of silencing them, of not listening to their voice. And so they don't heed the warning, right? And so they just keep on going about their merry business, and now the water's getting a little bit higher. Now it's in third class. Pretty soon it's in second class, and pretty soon you know what happens. And it should be pointed out that one of the reasons the Titanic did not have enough lifeboats is because they wanted to add 10 feet in either direction on the promenade deck to make folks strolling and mint julep drinking a little bit more pleasurable. If they hadn't had to add those 10 feet in either direction, there would have been enough boats, and nobody would have had to have died. But they had to add to the privilege, you see, of the folks who paid first class, and then folk died, you see. So in a sense, it's very much the same. When folks start getting laid off, when economic downturn happens, who gets hurt first? People who were poor and working class. But then you see upper middle class, professional, white collar folks getting laid off, and then they act like the world is coming to an end because they don't know how to deal with that. You see chaos in schools and inner city. You see crime and violence there. Nobody says anything, does anything, pays any attention to what the folks in those communities do in response, which many times was to implement programs to address violence. In the city schools, they do that because they've known they had to, usually with very little help from the federal government or from state governments. But suburban schools said, we don't have this problem. We don't have any violence to deal with. That's a problem for people over there. We don't need those programs. Y'all do what you need to do. We don't need those things over here. We don't live in Denver. We live in Littleton. Hello. We don't need those programs. We don't live in San Diego. We live in Santee. Hello. We don't live in Portland. We live in Springfield. Hello. You know, after a while, you start to get the point. that the more and more you run from the problem and fall prey to these stereotypes, which is very easy to do even for good people, when you are privileged and isolated, you actually make yourself worse off. And the irony of it all is that when you're privileged, when you have advantages, whether those are class, race, gender, sexual orientation, ability status, or a combination of all of those, which is really sort of like, you know, the grand prize, when you have all those advantages, you actually, in a weird, very ironic way, set yourself up for a fall because you don't gain the coping skills that are necessary to negotiate crisis. Let me explain to you the reason you don't see people of color who deal with racism, a lot more than teasing now, a lot more than mere bullying, but who deal with racism. The reason you don't see poor people of any race who deal with poverty, much more than bullying or teasing. The reason you don't see young women who deal with sexism and sexual harassment and gendered violence. The reason you don't see gays and lesbians and bisexual and transgendered students, all of these non-dominant groups going in and popping everybody in their school with a heartbeat or walking into their workplace and killing everybody that can breathe, is because, oddly enough, when one is subjected to discrimination and one is constantly dealing with being devalued, you have two choices. You either learn how to cope and survive or you die. But when you're not being buffeted by oppression, when you're not being buffeted by setback, when you're not being dealt with as an inferior, when you're not being devalued, you don't have to gain those same coping skills. And you know what? 99 times out of 100, that's okay, because you're not going to need them. But it's that one time. It is that one time that you wish you had them and now you don't because you always thought it was going to go a certain way and then you get laid off and you're 40 years old, white male, never been laid off in your life, didn't know what to make of it, and you're angry. And you're not just angry at the guy that laid you off. You're angry at everybody in the cubes next to you at work. You see? Or your girlfriend dumped you and you don't know how to deal with it because, by God, that's not supposed to happen. You see, it's not the non-dominant group folks that go off and do the craziest stuff. Right? Oh, there's violence and crime in poor areas, for sure. Somebody gets angry at somebody and they take that person out. It's very personal. Okay? But there's this wholesale violence. Take a gun and kill how many people you can. Right? Kill them all. Let God sort them out. Right? Right? That's an attitude. The kind of chaos that you see in these privileged spaces is over the top. Right? You see all kinds of interesting things. Child sexual molestation, 75% more common in white communities than black and Latino communities. Alcoholism, drug abuse, suicide, eating disorders, self-mutilation or cutting. All of these interesting pathologies, much more common among the privileged, not only white folks, but white folks with money. Now, what do all of those disorder or dysfunctions have in common? Serial killing, mass murder, sexual sadism, suicide, drug and alcohol abuse, sexual molestation, all this stuff, they're all pathologies about control. Now tell me, what people in a society are more likely to develop a pathology about control? Folks who never expected to be in control, or folks who always expected to and then found something went a little wrong in their life? See, I'm suggesting to you that privilege creates this sense of entitlement, a sense of expectation that's dysfunctional because things don't always go the way you expect. James Baldwin said it best. He said, the person who cannot suffer can never grow up, can never learn who they are. But that man who is forced to snatch his humanity from the fires of human cruelty, that rage to destroy it, learns something about himself if he survives the effort and even if he doesn't, that no school on earth and indeed no church can teach. He gains a sense of his own authority. And that is unshakable. For in order to survive, he must learn to hear the meaning behind the words, to look beneath appearances, to take nothing for granted. Because when one is constantly surviving the worst that life has to bring, one eventually ceases to be controlled by the fear of what life can bring. You see, and so there comes a point where that privilege, although it sustains you if you have it for a long time, eventually it may let you down when you most need it. When I wrote that Santee piece, I got an email from a member of the Columbine SWAT team who said to me how right I was by talking about the sort of blindness of that community to think that there could be chaos there as well. He said, let me tell you what happened when we showed up at Columbine High School. We got there, those of us in the flak jackets, ready to do what we would have done in Denver, which is go in and try and save whoever we could, and if people died, they died. This was a rescue event, a rescue mission. But we got there, and our commanding officer said to us, now, you can't just go in there with guns blazing, because these are, and this is a direct quote, these are white people with money and nice cars, and if we do something wrong, they will sue us blind. Now, here you had people with all kinds of privilege, racial and economic and geographic, all these kinds of advantage, but when they really needed it, see, it let them down. Because you have to deal with privileged people a certain way. You have to defer to them, right? You have to kiss them in the posterior region. You have to make them happy, right? And by making them happy, it might mean treating them better, and in the process of treating them better than you would somebody else, their kids die, right? And so privilege has a downside. It has a flip side. Unless we make this clear to people, unless we make this part of the rap, so to speak, if all we do is list the profit side of the ledger without the loss side of the ledger, for those of us who are white, the real risk and the real damage that privilege does to us, we're only going to get the most altruistic or saintly to join this battle. We have to show folk that there is indeed a shared victimization. No, it's not the same. It's not that white folks are victims of institutional racism the same way, or white supremacy or white privilege the same way that people of color are, but we're victims nonetheless. We are damaged by it. It turns us into something we're not. It turns us into collaborators when we don't want to be. See, even those, the best of us who don't want to be here, and I know I'm over time, but I got to tell this last little thing, and then I promise I'm done. Those of us who want to be something better and something different, those of us who resist racism, who fight it every day, this system of privilege turns us into collaborators as well. And so when I'm in fifth grade in Metro Public Schools in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm encountering a racist teacher who doesn't like me because of my close associations with black male students, and those were my friends, those are the folks I hung out with, and she was in this school system way too long, wasn't happy with that, viewed me as a race traitor, whatever kind of terminology we want to use, and made the mistake of telling my mother, made the mistake of telling her that any white parent that sent her child to school with savages was not fit to be a parent, and my mother had her removed the next week. Now wait. Now see, it happens every time. But there's another side to the story. My mom appreciates the applause, and I'll be sure to pass it on to her. But let me suggest to you something that she didn't think of and that I didn't think of at the time. Because see, we were resisting. She was resisting, and she taught me to resist, and we had this woman removed. You can't do much more resistance than that. We got rid of her. But I went back to school on Monday after she was released on Friday. And I sat in those advanced placement classrooms and honors classrooms with all white children, being told in a way much more subtle than Miss Crownover could teach it, that indeed those black children were savages. They didn't need her to teach that lesson. They could just track us in different tracks and they would teach it that way, see? Plan B. Right? And so my mom didn't see it. I went back to school and I was a collaborator with that because I didn't see it, she didn't see it, and therefore we didn't challenge it. So even the best of us are turned into something we don't want to be as long as this system exists. My grandmother, my father's mother, you've read this essay, some of you. One of the most anti-racist people I ever knew. Nobody in this room or me, myself, I'm going to be able to compare to her. When she was 17, she stood up to her Klan father now, because she'd fallen in love with this Jewish man who would become my grandfather and was already tired of his racism toward black folk, and this just sort of pushed her over the edge. And she went to him at the age of 17, 1937 now, and said, I'm tired of it, I'm not living with it anymore, and I'm going to give you two choices tonight, Pop. You either take your robes into the front yard and you burn them, or I'm going to take your robes into the front yard and I'm going to burn them. And he did it. And he quit the Klan, and he changed his life, and he accepted my grandfather and became a different man because he was challenged by this freedom fighter of a daughter of his, and she would stand up to others all throughout her life. But see, despite that commitment, despite her strength, despite the courage it took to do that, despite the clarity with which she fought racism for all of the years of her life that I knew her for sure, and going back before I was even born, for all of that, the last years of her life came, and like an awful lot of folks in this country and in this world, she began to suffer from the effects of Alzheimer's. And in those last few years of her life, if you know anything about the disease, now you know how it operates. First, it takes your memories, then it makes you forget names and places and who you are and who your children are. And you go through these phases, anger, insecurity, paranoia, rage. And she went through all of them. all the while being cared for by black women. And now what do you think in those moments of rage, in those moments of insecurity, in those moments of anger, or in those moments of paranoia, she called her black nurses when the chips were down? So you can just play it over and over in your head. You know what she called them, a word she never would have used from conscious thought and would have slapped the white off my face had I used it. But it was there. And it had been waiting. It had been hiding. It had been lurking in the far recesses of her mind for the opportunity to reassert itself and explode like a bomb. And it did it. When the chips were down, she reverted back to her conditioning because it's all she knew. She couldn't have been more clear. She couldn't have been more strong in her resistance, but it had turned her into that thing. Because when the chips were down, she had to take advantage of the only thing she had left, because her mind was gone, her health was gone, her family was gone, her memories were gone, but her whiteness remained. And so that word was one of the last words that she would utter before she stopped talking at all. And it says nothing about her. Not a thing. But it says an awful lot about her culture and an awful lot about the place that she was raised, an awful lot about this world and this society when you can't remember how to feed yourself, put a glass of water to your lips, or wipe your own ass. But you know what to call a black person when you're mad at them because you were taught that around the same time that you were taught to ride a bicycle. And just like riding a bicycle, once you get it, you never forget it. You see, that's the problem, because if that's true for her, if that's what racism did to her, if that's what white privilege did to her, if that's what white supremacy did to her, then it's what it has done to me. And I will have to work the rest of my life to undo that in me, let alone in the institutions with which I interact, and so will you, because that is the cost of it to white people. Turning you into something less than the beautiful human being that you were meant to be, you see. And so if you don't think there's a cost and a price to be paid, if you think it's just about helping the other, if you think it's just about bailing them out of a jam, if you think it's just about being there for other people, don't forget that it's also about saving yourself. It is about liberating yourself from the straitjacket that the culture has put on you as a white person and on me as a white person. And we don't talk about that one enough. But in the end, if we don't talk about it, if we don't make it visible, and if we don't eradicate it, we're going to have an awful lot more of us falling prey to that conditioning. And when the chips are down, we will call them in. And I don't want you to do that. And I don't want to do that. And I don't want my daughter to do that. And I don't want her potential children in the future to do that. We deserve better than that. Thank you very much, and God bless.